This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast. How's it going today, Greg?
Well, we just had a false start on this show, so it's a little frustrating, but hopefully this will work, so we'll head out.
Technology frequently is not our friend, but Hopefully this time everything will work out just fine. Mm-hmm. All right. And of course, the people listening have no idea, and we're doing this for you, all you wonderful listeners. So here we go. Here's a question from Maria. How would I answer a Christian friend who says she's now gay-affirming because she believes God gives us the grace to be wrong about some things, and that if she's wrong to affirm gay people, God will just correct her in heaven, and at least she was, quote, loving? She also believes the term in the Bible was mistranslated. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, God. I'm sorry, but it's so painful to hear questions like this because this friend is so clearly and obviously misinformed, all right? Do we have the freedom to be wrong and be forgiven? Well, of course, but that doesn't give us the freedom to be wrong on purpose. Amy, when was the piece I wrote? Maybe 2 years ago for Solid Ground called Faithfulness is Not Theologically Complicated or something like that. It's to address this kind of thing. And I looked at a whole bunch of controversial gray areas like Jesus being the only way and homosexuality and abortion and some other things. I said, these aren't controversial in the sense biblically. They're straightforward. In fact, you cannot misunderstand them if you are reading with a fair mind any of these issues, and then I gave rationales regarding them, and this is one of them. Paul says in Romans chapter 6, he begins, shall we sin more that grace should increase? No. That's my paraphrase. No. No, no, never, never, Also a paraphrase. May it never be is what he says. Are you kidding me? It's the way he's kind of saying. No. If we die to sin, we don't live in sin. So what you can't say is, well, I can be loving, and at least I'm loving. And if it turns out that I'm wrong, I'll be forgiven. But it doesn't turn out that you're mistaken in this. You are mistaken in this. And it's not loving. This is part of the lie. Mm-hmm. 1 Corinthians 13, love does not rejoice in unrighteousness. So I can be adultery affirming, so loving to adulterers. I can be fornication affirming. I don't want to make people feel bad because they having sex outside of marriage. I can be, alcoholic affirming. That's called enablement, by the way. At least we got straight on that one in our culture. I could be drug affirming. I mean, look at, why don't I just love the people? In other words, have a positive attitude towards people no matter what they do. That's not love. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's a parent knows better, even if they're a bad parent, they know that this is not the right way to parent. Just let them do whatever they want to do and smile and pat them on the back and be affirming, because these are tendencies that are destructive personally. All sin is destructive and destructive in terms of the relationship that we have with God. And God himself said, if what you're doing is these kinds of things over and over, you're not going to get any grace in the afterlife. You're not going to get in the kingdom. Now, by the way, he says that a number of times, and famously with regards to this issue, 1 Corinthians 6, 9. But there are other passages too. Will not inherit the kingdom of God. This is a person, Maria's friend, who has bought the progressive lie. It is a lie. Well, I'll be loving. What does that mean? I'll be affirming. Well, why don't you be loving to people who disagree with you on this issue? No, characteristically, they're not. I don't know about Maria's friend, but, they're nasty to those who don't go along with them on this issue. This is just this is so, you know, maybe theft isn't, I'm trying to think of some clear case of counterexample. But the problem with that is when you parody it, then the parody becomes true. It becomes a feature of actual life and people defend it. So I don't know. Look, homosexuality is wrong. It is contrary to God's purpose for male and female sexual relations. All right? It is a brokenness as a result of the fall and as a result of relationships in this life. What is our proper response to that? Holiness. And that's our proper response to all sexual issues. If we are violating holiness, we are abusing the grace of God. Titus chapter 2, the grace of God has appeared, teaching us to deny ungodliness. Okay, so if we are promoting ungodliness, then we are abusing the grace of God, and likely, depending on how much you're doing it, we're not even participants in the grace of God. And it certainly isn't loving to encourage destructive behavior. This is a lie of the culture. This kind of love is a lie. Love does not rejoice in unrighteousness. I don't know how I can make it any clearer. People go this route, Maria, like your friend, so often. And what they have done is they have bought the rhetoric of the LGBT crowd. We're loving. No, you're not. You're immoral. I mean, I'm just calling a spade, so to speak. I wouldn't talk in a curt way like this, but I'm speaking very plainly and clearly to our flock, to our people who ought to know better. You're not loving. You're immoral at that point. Now, it doesn't mean you have to be nasty and rude and unkind to people, but you cannot affirm unrighteousness and call it loving. That is an abuse of the word. That kind of love is a lie.
I think you've touched on the exact point here where her friend has gone wrong. She has bought the idea of what love means from the culture, and so now she thinks there's a conflict between God's commands to love your neighbor and God's commands about sexuality. So she's decided to err on the side of culture. That doesn't make sense at all.
Right.
That does not make any sense.
Good way to put it.
The God who has commanded us to love has given us commands showing us how to love. They're not in conflict with each other. If you think they're in conflict with each other, then somehow what you are understanding is incorrect. You should not assume that God was incorrect or the Bible is incorrect. You should assume the culture is incorrect. Why would you go with the culture? That makes no sense. You know, I was thinking about Romans 13, starting in verse 8. Here's what it says. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself.
Wow, that's great, Amy.
So
I'd not made that application before that verse, but what could be more clear?
Mm-hmm. The law is there to teach us how to love. So if you ignore the law in order to love, you have missed the entire point of the law.
You haven't loved your neighbor. You've done violence, moral violence to your neighbor. And you certainly haven't loved God. So both commandments are being violated in that situation.
She has simply been deceived by our culture's understanding of love. Mm-hmm. So, Greg, did you want to say anything about the term being mistranslated?
Oh, yeah, I will. Before I get to that, thanks for reminding me of that, by the way. Maria, to talk to your friend, I think you need to go to the passage that I mentioned, 1 Corinthians 13, which is the most thoroughgoing characterization of love, and the Romans 12 passage that Amy just cited, because there it ties loving your neighbor with moral conduct and there's sexual conduct that's part of that. It mentions adultery there. It doesn't mention other types of sexual sin, but I think the point is pretty obvious. We have to say regarding sexual sin the same thing that God says regarding sexual sin. And if we say otherwise, then we are not loving our neighbor. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, with regards to the mistranslation of the word homosexual, let me put it this way. The claim is that, and it's accurate actually, that in 1 Corinthians 6:9, Paul invented a new word to describe the behavior of homosexuality. Now, Alan Schliemann has done a whole piece on this, and it's on the website if you want more detail. But he took two words from the Old Testament law prohibiting homosexuality, and he put these words together, arsenikoites, which means men bedding men. And men bedding men, in the Greek word there, which is the one he put together, is the phrase that was consistently used to describe male homosexuality, even by the Jews. Men bedding men. And he took the terms from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, and out of Levitical passages that condemn homosexuality. Okay, now think about this. Who invented the term gravity? I don't know, maybe Newton did. But all he did was coin a term to describe something that had been there forever. The fact that you coin a term doesn't mean you invent the concept that the term refers to. And this is the mistake. And I don't even know why this isn't obvious to everybody who hears this argument. Well, the word homosexual wasn't even invented until 1932 or whatever it was. So what? Does that mean there wasn't homosexual behavior or homosexual inclination or homosexual lifestyle or homosexual quote-unquote orientation? And does that also mean that whatever that was going on that we now call homosexuality wasn't condemned by God? No and no. Those things were going on and they were condemned by God, and doesn't matter what you call it. All right? And actually, the word homosexual is an English word. Yeah, well, all the English words have to be invented or whatever to translate from the Greek. The question is, the text, when you read it, what does it say and what does it mean? Men with men committing indecent acts towards one another, abandoning the woman that was provided for them and burning in their passion toward one another. Okay, there you have a long description of what? Homosexual behavior and being condemned. Okay, well, you're just using that word homosexual. And that wasn't even invented until whatever. Okay, great. What it's describing is sexual behavior between men in which men are using each other's bodies in order to have orgasms. I didn't invent any of those words. Those concepts have been around for a long time. It describes the same thing. This is a non-issue. The whole word homosexuality wasn't. So what? The word gravity wasn't invented until such and so. Doesn't mean there wasn't gravity before that. The words are conventional. We make words to describe things that already exist prior to the words being used to describe them. I hope this doesn't sound like condescending, but this is dumb. This is a dumb argument. And it bothers me that people seem impressed by this.
I think, Greg, I don't think they've heard too much about the actual claim. I think they just hear the claim, oh, it was mistranslated, it was never condemned in the Bible, and they don't really look into it, or else they would see that there are many different places in the Bible where God's plan for sexuality is explained and certain things are prohibited, and it's consistent throughout the Bible. It's not just that one word happens to be misleading everybody who's reading the English text into thinking that homosexuality is condemned by the Bible. I just wanted to give everyone the name of the post that Alan wrote, because I think this argument is probably going to become more popular because there's a film coming out,
right,
called 1946. I think that's the name. 1946, The Mistranslation That Shifted a Culture. Mm. might make this idea more popular. So Allen wrote a piece called "The Claim About Homosexuality in the Film 1946 is Irrelevant." And he goes through all the reasons why this idea that there was a mistranslation that has somehow convinced, I suppose, only English-speaking Christians since 1946 that homosexuality is wrong. Now, just by looking at that, we have 2,000 years of Christians saying that homosexuality is wrong. Right. I don't understand how a translation in 1946 makes any difference to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend Alan's piece because he does go through all the explanations there. All right, Greg, let's do one more question here. This one comes from Bird. How do you respond to someone who argues the earliest books in the Bible are merely mythical fabrications and not factual because history can't verify their stories and they were written long after the events? Is believing in them blind faith?
Well, you know, it's curious when one says that history can't verify these events. How would history verify the event? Well, there would be writings that look like historical writings that say the events happened. But that's what we have in the Bible. We have accounts of things that happened that are clearly, maybe with some exceptions, historical genre. And the thing that bothers people is these things are entail supernatural elements, and this is why they don't trust them. And so they're importing a naturalistic presumption about the world to the text. And therefore they say, well, this must be a myth. Why? Because you got a talking snake. You got a flood, you know, kills all these people. You got a this, that, and the other thing. You got a Jonah and a great fish, and you, this is all, you know, it's a myth. Why would you say that? Because these things don't happen. Well, that's the question. Do they happen? Now, if you're a naturalist or materialist, you're going to say they don't happen in virtue of your prior beliefs. And so it's curious that the question was, do we just take this on faith? It is the objector that is taking their worldview on faith that raises the objection. Now, I'm not saying we just accept everything in a certain sense that's said blindly, but what the problem here is there is an imposition of a foreign worldview that causes one to doubt the veracity of these accounts. Okay. Now, Bill Craig has an interesting perspective, at least on the earlier chapters of Genesis, certainly prior to chapter 12 or maybe 11 or even 10. And he calls it, I think he calls it mytho-historical. In other words, these are about things that really took place, but they have mythic mythic ways of expressing them. Now, the problem that most people have when they hear that is they take the word myth to be a synonym for falsehood. It's just a story. It's a myth. And that's the way a lot of times people use it. But that isn't the way classically the term myth is used. In fact, C.S. Lewis was deeply influenced by Scripture because this was the true myth. In other words, there was something that allegedly happened that had deep, profound significance that might be expressed mythologically, but it actually took place in history. That's the resurrection of Christ. And so that's the true myth. And who's the fellow from the professor from University of Toronto now? Who's taken now with Lewis?
I don't know.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Oh, for goodness sake. Senior moment. Okay. But Jordan Peterson.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So this has really taken him, this idea that there can be a true myth. And he's taken with Lewis's thing. He's very sympathetic to Christianity, maybe even beyond that now. I don't know. But so just because it's got mythic dimensions in the classic sense of the term doesn't mean it's false. All right. So I let me put it this way. I don't think we should just read a chapter of fanciful things and say, well, that must be true. But this chapter comes in the Bible. And the Bible isn't just a bunch of disconnected stories that some are fanciful, some are not. It is an account of God working through history. There's a beginning and there's an end. There's a linear nature to it. This is something I explore in The Story of Reality, that book. And it holds together in a particular way. And there are different points in the story that can, in fact, be verified historically. And so what this does, no work of history, not a single work of history can take every event that is described and have individual, independent verification of it. Some things are just private to the author. He learns something, and there it is, and he puts it out there. He talks to one person, and the person said, this is what happened. He puts it in there. Where's your corroboration? Where's your multiple witnesses? Well, that isn't the way writing history works, because you can't have multiple witnesses that can attest to every single detail. But what you can do is write a work that, insofar as it can be tested, it can be demonstrated to be sound and reliable. And so you, in a certain sense, trust those parts that you can't test that way by the parts you can test that way, as long as you're taking the genre into proper consideration. And so I have good reason to believe that the Bible, taken as a whole, the record of the history of the Jews and the early church and Jesus' life, etc., etc. Remember, the Bible's not one book, it's a library of books. That all of these things are actually knit together in a supernatural fashion and are connected to each other. And so they corroborate, one corroborates the other. And so when you say take it on faith, I think you should trust it, but you don't take it on blind faith. But the mm-hmm. objector is, I think, taking his objections based on the blind faith they have in naturalism and materialism. Oh, these things don't happen. Well, miracles happen all the time. You want to learn about this? Get Craig Keener's book, Keener, Miracles. Actually, it's not one book, it's two, and it's not a book, it's a volume, two volumes. It's like the Encyclopedia Britannica, two of them. Craig Keener's Miracles, and he chronicles miracles from the beginning to the end, and he destroys David Hume's argument that you shouldn't believe in a miracle because they're allegedly so rare and you shouldn't believe in them. They're not rare. This is his point. So there is no good reason to presume naturalism and to take that by faith, and on the basis of the faith in naturalism, disregard claims in the Bible that are supernatural as being mythical.
You're absolutely right, Greg, that this is not blind faith because it's part of a whole network of ideas, not just one story by itself. It's part of a larger story, and we can see from the beginning to the end that there is a through line, that there's unity, that Jesus came as promised to continue the story of redemption. We can see this whole network, not to mention the ideas of our evidence for the existence of God and our reasons for thinking he is real and that he actually has inspired these books. But I just want to make a quick book recommendation. There's a book called The Bible Among the Myths. It's by John Oswalt. And it talks about how the Bible and its ideas are dramatically different from all the other ideas that were happening at the time. So I think that can give you some idea of how to look at what the Bible is saying and to see how it is different from the myths that were around it at the time. And hopefully that will be helpful to you. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. And that's it for today. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.